There was a student here today doing a doctorate in mindfulness, and I was relating to her the practice they have in Sri Lanka, where, or they used to have in Sri Lanka, apparently, so I am told, that when a child began to go to school, the teacher would set up a book for the child. And I think book in Sinhala is pota. And in the book, the child would be encouraged to write any good deed that was done each day. So the girl or boy would come back to school the following day, and the teacher would ask, so what good deed have you done? And kid might say, well, I helped mom with the dishes or something like that. And the teacher would encourage her, well, you write it in the book. Write your good deed in the book. And this book is called a ping pota. Ping is from punya, which is merit. So it's a merit book. And apparently in more ancient times, maybe not more recently, but a person would then put these things in the book for a whole lifetime. And then when the person was dying, the relatives would take the ping pota out and read, when you were 5 years old, you helped granny do the dishes. And when you did, imagine a kind of situation like that where people are reading out to you all the good things that you've done. Might have forgotten yourself. And how happy that could make the mind. So to some extent we remember our stories. But what we feel is the momentum of our stories. So even though I might not remember the narratives of what I did when I was 5 years old or 6 years old or 7 years old, I still am a part of that momentum. So for whatever goodness that I have practiced, that momentum is a part of this moment, and for whatever foolishness I've been involved in, that momentum is a part of the moment, even though I might not know the particular instances of it, the stories of it. And so we are inheritors of that. This is our inheritance. I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. And so obviously to have any kind of a meaningful life, that part, that karmic part of my life, has to be meaningful as well. So wholesome and compassionate and moral and contemplative. And that's what we call the staircase to heaven, different than a Pink Floyd song. The Buddha's staircase to heaven is a good karma, where through the cultivation of a good communication, empathy towards people, responsibility in the work we do, skill in what we're asked to do, the development of skill, maturity in taking responsibility, and so many other things, that we develop a human character which has a kind of fullness to it, is not fraught with a lot of remorse and regret, but actually has a lot of happiness, kind of a lot of sincere happiness, because what has to be done has been done skillfully. So we have a kind of a ping pota that we are a part of. Again, we might not remember the memory, but we are certainly, certainly what we live in to some extent. So that's a huge part of our lives, and it creates a foundation for the transcendent part of Buddhism, where we go beyond karma, or we find that which is not simply conditioned by social factors, emotional factors, and such like. And that other part of the Dhamma practice, requires a commitment to the present moment, a kind of very, very determined commitment to the present moment, because our minds so easily run into or pick up elements from the past, constantly mulling them over, thinking them over, and just being caught up into them, and constantly making intentions towards the future, towards what I want to become and what I need to do, driven by various kinds of desires or fears or anxieties or resentments or angers, basically driven by delusion. So the breaking through of delusion, the breaking through of self-view, one of the important elements is to realize that the Dhamma is not a matter of time, that it's something to be realized here and now. And that sense of non-becoming, not the non-movement into the future, but the kind of again, this commitment and understanding that opening to the present moment is the only place that transcendence is realized, becomes a very determined kind of intention in our practice. So we have two kinds of determinations we're making. We're making the determinations to be to live more skillfully, say, here in community, to try to relate to each other in ways of compassion rather than in ways of delusion, to relate to each other from the place which is not fraught with fixed perceptions and fixed judgments and so on. In other words, a heart which is not just functioning from perceptions of which are driven by greed, hatred, and delusion. So that's one part of our lives, the social part, the Vinaya part, the ethical part. And then that other part, which is going on inside our minds all the time, is the letting go of the whole business, the non-attachment to the khandhas, the non-attachment to these social identities, which isn't a dismissal of it, but it's the finding in your heart that place of awareness which sees khandhas as khandhas, which really sees mind as mind, which sees emotion as emotion, rather than a self caught up in all of that. And that place and that kind of crisp knowing, that knowing which is not polluted by delusion, is inherent in any given moment. And so the determination that we try to make in practice of liberation is to abandon all elements from the past and not make any, and abandon the projections into the future. And that takes quite a lot of vigor. It takes a lot of you have to make strong intentions not to be constantly thinking about yourself as a past entity and a future possibility. And it comes from right understanding. Right understanding is to see that the Dhamma, knowing the way things are, is really not a matter of time. Time is very important to understand that way. But our social engagement is a matter of time. So I make determinations to be more skillful in craft or communication, and that there's an improvement there. There is a bettering of our humanity. We do become more skillful in community or in the way we talk to each other. And the doing of that requires the kind of lessening of attachment to our views and opinions. If you look at how sometimes the intensity of conflict that we can have in our lives, how much of that is views and opinions, and there's nothing wrong with views and opinions, but attachment to that, you know, the grasping of that creates a very strong sense of self and other. And it's doubly detrimental because it's detrimental both, it causes, it's a source of suffering individually and socially, but also it binds us to time. It binds us to the conditioned realm, and the unconditioned realm is not an opinion. And so to see a viewpoint or an opinion as anicca dukkha anatta, to really awaken to that and continue to let go, abandon that, is a transcendent practice. But the ego, we get a lot of confidence in having very clever views and opinions. We can, people get a lot of praise for that. People are very clever. But that is a very, it's a very shallow place, because it's not really, it's just intellectual. It's not really heartfelt freedom. So cleverness is not the same as wisdom. Clever views and opinions are powerful. You know, if we're relating to other people and we're impressing them with our cleverness, or you're at a committee meeting and someone is quick and clever, they have a lot of power. They can be right. They can certainly be right. There's nothing wrong with them. But the mind, which does not need an opinion, does not need a conclusion. The mind which is free from that, those structures of intellectual comfort, that's a different kind of mind. It's a mind very silent, a mind which is not defensive, a mind which does not need to impress other people. It's a mind which is self-reliant, and it's a mind which has an open heart. So the movement towards thought and opinions and views, the picking up of past references, the memories, fantasy, you begin to really make strong intentions not to pick those up. So the fantasies or the memories of betrayal, situations of betrayal or situations of failure, or sexual memories, or sexual fantasies, or all kinds of historical things that came up, to make strong intentions to see that it's just memory. Just memory, just that. That's the beginning of entering into the timeless, because memory is a function of time, and when we attach to memory, then we recreate ourselves. I am such and such, and I did that, or someone else did this to me, and I had those experiences, and that then creates the intentions for a future person. And then there's the anticipation of the future, or the revenge in the future, or the fulfillment of a fantasy in the future. And so the mind swings from past to future, past to future, past to future. And in that, there's nothing new. It's dead. It's old. It's me, itself. Nothing new, nothing fresh, no insight, no vipassana. So to actually allow insight to take place, to allow a new perspective to take place, what you have to do, you have to be available. And if I'm preoccupied with past and future, or my own cleverness, or my self-judgments or whatever, then that preoccupation prevents insight and binds me to the old, to the old ego. So, like living in the monastery, we have these two responsibilities. We have a social responsibility to each other to try to fulfill our duties and be mature individuals in living in this place, so that to not become institutionalized, where we expect others to do things for us, or to actually have, you know, take initiative and see how can I make this place good for everyone who is here, in whatever way, in whatever skills I have. That's a very mature kind of way of looking at it, rather than just say doing my duty, doing my little bit. So there's a kind of broad sense of like a parent has for family. This needs to be done. I'll see how much I can do. And then we all have responsibilities and so on. And then the capacity to communicate with each other. That's a skill that we're always working on developing. And that's our social responsibility, to live by the Vinaya. And the Vinaya isn't just the keeping of rules. The Vinaya also has the motivation, like the Metta Sutta. Think about the Metta Sutta or the Brahma Viharas. If the Vinaya were just a kind of rule keeping, if that's all it was, just rule keeping, then what about all those other teachings like the Brahma Viharas, Metta Sutta, these kinds of things? So the Vinayas, the suttas and the Vinaya, they go hand in glove, don't they? And so our observance of the Vinaya is imbued with the heart qualities that the Buddha was recommending. And so to reflect on those, a boundless goodwill, boundless compassion, boundless gladness, boundless joy, boundless equanimity, to actually not just, just to try those out, just to give those a go, to make, to give the mind that kind of exercise of contemplating goodwill and making it boundless, to go through that exercise. It's not an exercise in rule keeping. It's not something you just are diligent at with the rules, but it's something you do with your mind. It can be quite challenging. Gladness to actually learn how to bring the mind to a sense of uplift through gladness, through the beauty of nature, or through the beauty of another person's aspiration, through their goodness. So to actually look at each other in terms of, like our friend that was here, who just left today. You think about him, how many challenges he has from a life which has been lived unskillfully, but now is being lived skillfully. Where one could look at that and be critical of him, but all of us feel that sincere aspiration. And so, you know, there's a sense of good on you. You're really giving it a go. It's a tough practice for you, but well done, well done. And so that's always a helpful kind of thing to remember in community, is that we are all pieces of work. We are all working on our stuff, as to say, and that all of us will suffer from limitations. We will suffer from the manifestation of defilements. It can't be any other way. And we're here, you know, when we live together, we are part of a kind of purification process. Because the defilements that we experience, they're going to come up here. They're going to come up between us, or with this situation, and so the frictions and irritations and likes and dislikes that we experience, that's the only way they could come up, because there's no one else around. And it's not really about the person. It is to some extent socially, but it's my own heart, how it gets entrapped into limited perspectives and views. But if you step back, well, each of us actually is doing a pretty good ping pota. You know, we're all we're living morally, we are giving a lot to this monastery, we all work hard, we're practicing renunciation, we're quite diligent in all kinds of ways. So I think logically you can see, as far as humanity goes, this is pretty good. What human beings get up to, we're doing very, very well. And that's not just sort of empty praise. I mean, it is true. To live like this is not for the many folk. But within that, each of us has buttons we have limitations and we have difficult material we might be facing from who knows where, and our perceptions get warped sometimes by that, sometimes they don't. So to just keep, you know, it's always good to keep in mind where in my relationship to people in this monastery, where do the Brahmaviharas fit? That's very, very important to kind of see where is the goodwill, where is the compassion, where is the gladness, and of course the equanimity. So then within the structure of a training monastery, there's certainly, we have very high standards, and there's need for admonishment and criticism and so on. But also we always have to remember that it comes in the context of the Brahmaviharas. And that's a beautiful consideration. Because if we didn't have the Brahmaviharas and we were just a bunch of rule keepers, that would be a very grim way to live one's life. But having said that, if it was just Brahmaviharas and we had no Vinaya, we'd have no way to have a common agreement or common training. And so there's a kind of rigor to monastic life, a rigor to the understanding of the Vinaya, understanding of our duties and our relationships and so on. But also there's a softness to it, and the softness is around the Brahmaviharas. We are a work in progress in that, when we're learning how to do that. So as I like to joke, when I was a younger monk and I first took on the duties of being a senior monk, I would have to be very careful of my inner fascist, where I could be very, very critical and judgmental of people. But also the other was true too. There was that in me, but there was all the other, where I was afraid of being disliked. I was afraid of people not liking me, then I would be afraid to criticize. And my mind would swing between those two. One is being the kind of terrible policeman and saying, it's got to be this way, it can't be any other way. And then the other one of being afraid and just letting things fall apart. As long as you're happy, I won't say anything. Those are exaggerated extremes. But you can see how they do arise in the way we function with each other. We can be very, very critical, or we can just be very laissez-faire. But if one has a sense of the training and one keeps learning about that, and one has a sense of the Brahmaviharas, then it's possible to have very good standards. And Ajahn Chah's monasteries have very high standards, you know, the standards of taking care of the monastery and being diligent in our various practices are very, very high. So you can do that and not just become a opinionated, obnoxious fundamentalist. And this is where the Vinaya goes off, when people just hold it as an opinion. And my opinion is better than your opinion, or this is the way you really do it. You know, this is the correct way to do it, and that's the kind of arrogance that you find in any kind of like a system of rules. But if you contemplate the Brahmaviharas in relation to anyone, then goodwill, compassion, gladness, equanimity, there's no place for arrogance there. There's no place for putting people down. There's no place for conceit, really. It's the end of conceit. So the more we we reflect on the kind of time-bound quality of the ego, we look at that, and you get a hold of that, you see how the sense of self creates the other, and the other creates a sense of self, how that's bound up in time. And we begin to let go of that, then the heart has much more openness. And from that openness of heart, we're able to read each other better, and we're able to respond to situations in a much more authentic and appropriate way, appropriate to time and place. But the attachments to views and attachments to ego and attachments to fear and attachments to anger and aversion and so on, you create a lot of difficulties in the heart. And that's a part of it. If I think about, I remember once there was a very, very difficult monk in the monastery, a young monk who was just so problematic, and he was hard work, and it was really wearing me down. He was very demanding and very, very troubled person, to say the least. And I was getting quite overwhelmed by it and not reacting all that well. And then one of the monks came to me and said, "You're not handling this very well." And I thought that was the most unkind thing to say. You know, it's like, I know I'm not handling it well. And it's driving me nuts. Whereas another monk said, you know, this is difficult for you. You want to take a few days off? You know, that was a lovely response, because even though the other monk could see that, both could see that I'm having a hard time, one came at it with compassion and the other came at it with judgment. So it's not like we're putting aside our critical faculty, it's still there, but we're trying to let it come from a sense of empathy and heart. And we can't always do that, but those are the encouragements we get from the teaching. So this Last of Us, so we've been all listening to these different tapes and considering that, how the real structures work and how the protocols are and so on. But do keep in mind that there's also the whole part of the heart, which is very, very important to make this a kind of a beautiful, beautiful way of living. I know Ajahn Chah could be very, very, very directive and very, very strong in criticizing us for sloppy behavior or whatever, but when you're ever with him, there's tremendous love and compassion. You never felt like he was using his power, his position to domineer, or that he was coming from any negative, averse place. But there was lots of power there. He gave a lot of very strong direction to say that you don't do it that way. You don't do it that way, you do it this way. But one never felt it was coming from any sense of delusion. So it's possible to have. You know, compassion does not imply weakness and just acquiescing to the delusions that might be around, or the sloppies that might be around. But it gives it a tone of appropriateness. So to, like Ajahn Chah's firmness was very compassionate. He's really willing to train us and say, don't do this, don't do that. And one saw that it couldn't have been fun for him. No nice thing to do, but because he had the compassion to do that. So as we offer each other reflections in this life of training, then to try to listen and say, is that true? Is it not true? So here, like we've been reading from Lompa Cha, so how we take praise and blame, how does that affect us? Do we get defensive if someone's critical, or do we take it on board and say, is that true? Is it not true? And then when we offer criticism, or we offer reflection to say, where's my heart? Am I pure in this? Am I concerned for the welfare of the person I'm criticizing? Do I understand the training, the rules, and able to offer admonishment? Or is it appropriate to time and place? This is very important, not just to kind of say something. So the training in mindfulness and being able to dialogue things and offer reflection is a skill in right speech. And that's also part of our training. When we live in the head, when we live in thoughts, when we live in self, when we live in time, we often approach life in a kind of reactive way. But when we abide more from the heart, then our approach to life is more, I think it's more considered, more. There's a kind of pause in the heart. It's not just a reaction from the head, from an opinion or whatever. So to cultivate the heart is very beautiful in itself, but also gives us a space from which we relate more skillfully. Okay, I'll leave that for reflection tonight.
Dhamma kataya sadhu karanda dhamma se.